everyone, and welcome to the Think Inc. podcast. I'm Susie Jamil, owner and director of Think Inc. At Think Inc., we elevate ideas through live events, and here is a showcase of our online live event series, Outside the Box. Today's show is with a futurist and founder of One Shared World, Jamie Metzl. Jamie is a leading technology and healthcare futurist and geopolitical expert, a science fiction novelist, a faculty member of Singularity University Exponential Medicine, and a senior fellow of the Atlantic Council. In 2019, he was appointed to the World Health Organization Expert Advisory Committee on Human Genome Editing. Jamie previously served in the US National Security Council, State Department, and Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and with the United Nations in Cambodia. He is the author of A History of the Cambodian Genocide, the historical novel The Depths of the Sea, and the genetic sci-fi thrillers Genesis Code and Eternal Sonata, and the recent bestseller Hacking Darwin, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Humanity. An avid Ironman triathlete and ultramarathoner, Jamie holds a PhD from Oxford, a law degree from Harvard Law School, and is a graduate from Brown University. The Q&A today is conducted by Toby Walsh, who is a leading researcher in artificial intelligence. He is Scientia Professor of Artificial Intelligence at UNSW and leads the Algorithmic Decision Theory Group at Data61. He is named the rockstar of Australia's digital revolution. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and tell your friends. Here is Jamie Metzl.
Thank you to all of you and to our friends at Think Inc. It's a strange moment to be coming together. We're all feeling a great sense of shock at the way that our world has changed so rapidly over these past short number of months. And yet we all can feel that something new is happening, something new is opening. And there's a very natural response to this kind of change. And we all have that instinct, just this hope that our lives are going to snap back to what they were, that this will be something like a snow day and we'll just take a step back and the snow will be cleared. I know you don't have that much snow in Australia, but once in a while, and the snow will be cleared and then our lives will just go back. And I think all of us are going through this process of mourning a little bit, especially as it dawns on different people at different times. I know I was very early and other people maybe a little bit later, realizing that those lives that we've had are never entirely going to snap back exactly, at least exactly in that same way. And that's really difficult. And we need to take a moment. We need to acknowledge that. But then we all need to recognize that this world is changing and it's changing incredibly fast. And for us to succeed in the world that's coming and for us to build a better world from the in some cases, the ruins of this world that is now collapsing on many levels, we have to begin our pivot. We have to know where we're going and we have to start moving there in a really fundamental way. And that's why communities like this are so important, because none of us can figure this out alone. We are biologically social beings. We need to come together in whatever ways that we can. We need to learn. We need to draw on our communities and build our communities to get through this together. And we're going to do that. And that's why I'm just really thrilled and honored to be here with you. And it's just a crazy, crazy moment. If you walk into any hospital in pretty much any country in the world, even now, there are people crying in two different wings of the hospital. In one wing, they're crying because of the loss, and whether it's parents or grandparents or people who we're tragically losing because of cancer or heart disease or now COVID. But always in another wing of the same hospital, there are people who are crying for a different reason. And they're crying because of the miracle of life, because of birth. And so we're all feeling the pain of this destruction, but this is also a moment of rebirth. And I want to talk about both of those things and our need to pivot at this really, really essential moment. So when I think of pivoting, there are three different steps in the pivoting process. First, we need to understand the essence of the moment we are in. Second, we need to connect with our core values to know who we are and set our North Star for where we would like to be. And third, we need to begin traveling in the direction of our North Star to realize our best selves even in this radically new environment. So that's how I would like to organize my talk today, around those three principles. And let me start first talking about what's happening now. And I'd like you all to imagine that you have a magical optical device and it has a little knob on it. And when the knob is turned all of the way to one end, it's a microscope. And when you turn it all of the way to the other end, it's a telescope. So we're going to start with the knob turned all the way toward a microscope. And we're going to peer into that microscope. And what are we going to look at? You're right. We're going to see an RNA virus. And our world is being transformed by this RNA virus, this novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, but really the coronavirus is what we're all calling it. And viruses are hijackers. They are the ultimate hijackers and survivors. They don't have their own locomotion mechanism. It's a question of whether they're even living organisms. But what they do is they hijack hosts and they turn hosts into basically machines, replication machines, doing their business. And we humans have become the super hosts for these viruses. And we've always been hosts, and all species are hosts for viruses, but we've become super hosts. How's that happened? Well, we've destroyed the natural barriers between us and other species that are hosts, like bats. There are lots of us. There are 7.7 billion humans. So if you're a virus and you want to replicate, it's a very good strategy to jump on humans. We're connected to each other. So because of globalization and all of our connections with each other, these viruses, and especially infectious viruses like this one, can spread very rapidly. And this is a novel virus. Our species has never encountered it before. That means every human, so far as we know, is a potential host. And that's a really big deal, because there are billions of viruses in this world and they're constantly replicating. And not every virus is a threat to us. As a matter of fact, some viruses are part of our microbiome. Some viruses over time have become part of our DNA. A lot of our genome is made up of viral genomics, what used to be viral genomics. But this coronavirus has found this sweet spot between it's contagious, it's asymptomatic for a long time, and it's not so deadly that it immediately kills the hosts. And that's why we're seeing this incredible outbreak. So now we're going to turn that knob a little bit. We're going to widen the aperture from the virus to the outbreak of the virus in Wuhan, probably in November of last year. There's a lot of debate about where this virus began. And certainly, this is a naturally, for as far as everything we know, a naturally occurring virus. But that doesn't mean it's a naturally occurring virus that began in the Wuhan seafood market. As a matter of fact, I think that's actually a highly unlikely origin. I think there's a quite likely possibility that it was an accidental leak from very well-intentioned research that Chinese researchers may have been conducting in one of the two Wuhan virology labs that were already studying bat coronaviruses. So maybe we'll see that over time. But when we widen our aperture, we have to start with the origin of this outbreak. And then that begins with this absolutely fundamental, deep failure of China in the first 3 weeks to respond to this virus. And in many ways, we're all suffering because the extensive network that China had set up under SARS spectacularly failed in those critical first few weeks when there was a very active cover-up. China got its act together a few weeks later, but had there been a thoughtful emergency response in those first few weeks rather than a cover-up, we wouldn't be in this situation at all. It's easier to put out a stove fire than a kitchen fire, than a house fire, than a city fire. And so that opportunity was lost. And then when the virus began to spread, different countries did a better and worse job of responding. Taiwan, which had the common experience of SARS, they declared their national emergency on December 31st, and they were way ahead of the curve. And that's why Taiwan has handled this very, very well, along with other countries like South Korea, Iceland, New Zealand, Australia has done an excellent job. Germany, European countries, most European countries weren't as good, even as the European countries that I mentioned. And the United States did an absolutely terrible job. And I'm sitting here in New York at the epicenter of this. We have a really just devastation here. And that's because of the fundamental political failure that happened here in the United States. But this failure didn't begin just this year, even the end of last year. It began decades ago when we had leaders like Ronald Reagan who were claiming that the government isn't the solution. The government is the problem. We've had politicians campaigning against the government. We've had a breakdown of our civic culture and come to see politics as a form of entertainment, of reality television, rather as something that's deadly, deadly serious. We've had an assault on our media, on our mediators of what is and isn't true or credible, this whole quote unquote fake news debate. And all of those played into the fundamental failure on the part of the United States, and particularly the administration, to call this crisis early. And that was, we are still suffering. As I said, with these kinds of pathogenic outbreaks, early is everything. And we failed here in the United States, and we failed in the response, and we are suffering terribly as a result. But then on top of that, we have the President of the United States blaming others. And there certainly is a lot of blame to go around. I've been very public saying that I'm against people who say now is not the time to point fingers. We have to point fingers, but thoughtfully and carefully, because for all we know, there's an even more deadly pathogen that's already been released. So we really need to figure out what happened. It's like when a plane crashes, we don't say now is not the time to ask why. We say we better figure out what happened because there are other planes in the air. And so certainly, as I mentioned, China failed. Certainly, as I mentioned, the United States failed. But the President of the United States has been very vocal in his criticism of the World Health Organization. So let me just say a little bit, and I, as Toby mentioned, I'm an expert advisor to the World Health Organization on human genome editing. And I have a great faith in the WHO. It is an absolutely critically important organization. But the World Health Organization could have done better earlier in this crisis. It could have called this pandemic a little bit earlier. It could have been a little bit more critical of the news that was coming out of China. But I think we need to take a step back because this is all about perspective. And maybe we need to twist our little optical machine to look at the WHO role and all of us in a different way. Imagine in a different world, in a different scenario, maybe this is a different view through our optical machine, that we had the WHO that we need. That WHO would have had a global surveillance network. When the tripwire was hit of a pandemic, that WHO would have sent an emergency response team. And that emergency response team, as your Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has suggested, would have functioned like a weapons inspector team. It wouldn't be a choice. Maybe we'll let them in, maybe we won't. Every country would have to let them in. And then they would go in and they would work with local authorities to stop the pathogen in its tracks. If that didn't work, they'd have the resources and mandate to respond globally, to coordinate a campaign to end it. And then when that succeeded, they would be constantly building capacity everywhere in the world, particularly in the most vulnerable states, because all of our health is connected. But that's not the WHO that we, all of us, our states, have created. So let's turn the knob a little bit to a wider aperture, because we talked about the governance crisis that became a health crisis. Everybody knows what I'm about to say, so I'll move through this quickly. But this health crisis is very, very serious, and nothing approximating normalcy other than in the most isolated places. Maybe New Zealand can get to this state, but nothing that will feel fully normal will arrive until there's a vaccine. And that's going to take a long time. maybe a year is the dream scenario, maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And we talk about flattening the curve. It's essential that we do that, but that also is another way of saying spreading the pain. But we're also going to likely see over the coming months the brunt of this pandemic shift from wealthier countries to poorer countries, particularly in the southern hemisphere. And that is going to lead to all kinds of dangerous cascading. But we're also going to see trends that maybe would have taken months to play, maybe would have taken years to play out, or decades, are now arriving in weeks and months. The way I talk about this is the future crashing into the present. And we're already seeing that through virtualization. Who would have imagined that our parents and grandparents would have become Zoom experts in weeks? Who would have imagined that we could do our education, our healthcare, everything virtually over the course of weeks? Already in the United States, we're stepping up the role of artificial intelligence in medical diagnoses. This has been happening for a while, but it's speeding up because there are so many claims on our healthcare professionals. And we know that the virus is moving at the speed of globalization, but our response is also moving at the speed of globalization. Scientists around the world are networking, are collaborating. And it's ironic when Susie Jamil decided she wanted to have me come and speak, it was because of my book, Hacking Darwin, which I hope that you'll all read, which is about this unbelievable, almost godlike powers that our one little species suddenly has with these tools of the genetics revolution. And as we suffer from this ancient virus, these incredible tools of the genetics revolution are our superpowers that we can bring to this fight. The genome of the virus was sequenced within 2 weeks. There are new treatments that are developing because of these technologies. There's lots of work going in to potentially creating genetically modified vaccines. So we're writing the code of the response. And we already have three genetically modified humans, the so-called three CRISPR babies born in China, who were modified exactly to increase viral resistance, in this case to HIV, even though it was highly unethical and not successful. So we will go there in our future. We will have genetically engineered children, and those children will be genetically engineered to protect us from these deadly threats, including deadly pathogens and genetic diseases. So this governance crisis that became a health crisis is now morphing into national and global economic crises. I don't need to tell everybody here that we're experiencing a massive economic downturn. We're having disruptions of major industries and markets. The price of oil has collapsed. Commercial real estate is collapsing, and we're all going virtual. We're not all going to go back to physical work life in the way that we were. Large group events are not going to happen, at least here in the United States, for a very long time. I don't think we're going to have a full stadium American football game here until at least 2022. I'm in New York. There isn't going to be a full Broadway performance for a long, long time. And just the patterns of our human consumption, the patterns of our life are going to shift. And a lot of these are trends that, again, would have happened over decades, but the future is crashing into the present. We don't live in a static world, but generally we have a rate of change that is comfortable with us, comfortable for us. We were already on a path of exponential change because of our super converging technologies, but now everything is speeding up, and it's going to change the way we live, and it's going to change it rapidly. And people will feel, even now with all these virtual meetings and Zoom birthday parties and memorial services, people feel that's not how we live. And maybe it's not, but the way we lived even before this crisis would have been totally unfamiliar to our ancestors who were nomads in the savannas of Africa. We are a species that is constantly changing, and that this is part of our new reality. As I said before, this is not some kind of short-term shift that's going to snap back. This is our life,
And we are going to have a new normal. It's going to be different from the old normal. It'll incorporate parts of it, but it's not just going to
snap back. So then let's widen our aperture and turn the knob a little bit more. And then we see these series of government crises that have already happened and will happen. So the first government to fall because of the coronavirus crisis was that in Kosovo. Then they had a soft coup in Hungary. And we're going to see over the coming months a series of cascading collapses and government crises, particularly in countries with the least resilience and the weakest governments. But there's another country that's going to have a major political crisis, and that's my country here in the United States. We already were having a very difficult political time, but we're now moving into our presidential election season, and we are going to have a highly, highly contested presidential election. We're going to be attacked by bad actors, whether from Russia or elsewhere, because this is the moment when the people who are uncomfortable with the role that America has played in the world, this is the moment where they will try to change the global balance of power. And it's a heartbreak for me to be speaking to a primarily Australian audience about this, because when I think of what are America's greatest moments, among our greatest moments in our entire history, was when these young Marines, many of them teenagers, landed in Guadalcanal in 1942, and they saved ourselves, but they saved Australia. And Americans and Australians and other peace-loving peoples of the world, we fought and won the Second World War. And then from the ashes of the destruction of that war, we came together to build a post-war international system that included the United Nations. It included concepts of universal human rights and international law and free trade and the foundations of our lives and our freedoms, and our economic success has been based on those foundations that we all built together, but for a long time, more than seven decades, have been guaranteed by the United States. And the United States has been far from perfect in that time. And we all know Vietnam, Iraq, and we can make a long list of those places, Guatemala. But all in all, the United States played that role. But now the United States is unfortunately suffering from an autoimmune disease internally, as well as a changing geopolitical environment that includes a rise of a almost peer competitor in China that doesn't appear to have the same idea of being a stakeholder in building this global commons that benefits everybody. I hope that will change. And if it changes, we should all be thrilled and we should welcome China to play that role. But so far, I haven't seen China playing that role. And so this system that we've lived in is now under attack. It's ironic. In late 2018, I was invited to give a keynote talk in Wuhan, China. And I went there and I was talking about China's international borders. And before the trip, I said, you know, I have views that are going to be uncomfortable for a Chinese audience, but I'm going to go all the way to Wuhan and I'm comfortable speaking as long as you give me your guarantee that I won't be censored. I was given those guarantees. And then the morning of my talk at this major conference at the leading university there, I had three guys come to my hotel and they said, we're really sorry. We'd like to ask you to change your remarks because we don't want you to say anything that could be construed as critical of China. And I said, hey, I'm really sorry. I'm here because I believe that U.S.-China relations depend on an honest and open exchange of ideas. And if we can't even talk to each other, how are we going to move forward together? And so we had a conversation. I was very loving, but I didn't bend. And they said, oh, we're really sorry. We're going to have to cancel your talk, but you can come to the conference as long as you sit in the back and don't say anything. And so I was there anyway. And so I agreed and I was in the back of the conference. I listened all day and there was a lot of propaganda. And at the end of the day, they had an open Q&A session and somebody was walking around with a microphone. And I just raised my hand. I think not everybody was read into the plan. Somebody handed me the microphone and I got up and for about 10 minutes, I gave a shortened version of what I meant to say. And that is, I come originally from Kansas City, the hometown of President Harry Truman. And I really believe in this post-war international system. I think it's been the foundation of helping so many different people around the world, including Americans. But right now, what I'm seeing is the American government, the administration, is hacking away at the foundations of our world. And the Chinese government is hacking away at the foundations of our world. And if we hack away at these foundations and we don't have foundations, we'll wind up with the kind of chaos that destroyed our world. We had to fight two world wars to learn that lesson. And I fear that that is what is happening now. And that's why I feel that this year, 2020, will be seen in historical terms as the end of the post-war era. What began in 1945, I think will come to an end in 2020. And that doesn't mean that it's the new world is going to be non-recognizable, but it means that things are really, really going to change. Antonio Gramsci, who is an early 20th century communist philosopher, he has a quote that I use a lot. The old world is dying. The new world has not yet emerged. And in the twilight, rise up monsters. So we have this dangerous moment where this world that we've known that's delivered incredible peace, security, stability, and so many other things is breaking down before our eyes. And we don't have something to replace it. And what will likely fill that gap, if we're not careful, is the old balance of power politics. And we know where that ends because we've seen this story before. And that was the late 19th and early 20th century. That's what brought us here. So if you're scared, that's an appropriate response. This is a scary moment for all of us. But that's why we have the second part of my talk. And that is asking, what is our North Star? Where are we heading? And more importantly, who are we? What are the values that we want to bring to bear as we help build this new world? And these are the defining moments of our lives. There are lots of times in our lives we can just kind of cruise along like we're on cruise control on a highway. But there are critical moments like this where the decisions we make define our futures on so many different levels. I mentioned the world wars. There was a moment just like this after the First World War, and people just like us came together recognizing that there was a new environment and new technologies, in that case, the radio and other things. And there was a struggle to see whether the forces of construction or destruction would win the day. And as you all know, the forces of destruction won. And that's how we got to World War II. And at the end of World War II, the forces of construction won. And that's how we got 75 years of peace, security, and stability, as imperfect as it was. And in those days, in the early 1940s, we had leaders like FDR and Winston Churchill, and we could just rally behind those leaders. But tragically, we don't have those leaders right now. But what we have to do, what we all have to do, is divide up that job among ourselves. Everybody is a little bit of FDR. Everybody is a little bit of Winston Churchill. Everybody has to be a little bit of Mahatma Gandhi. Because in 1941, those leaders articulated a vision of where we were heading. And whether it was independence for India or the Four Freedoms or the Atlantic Charter, these were North Stars, directions around which we can rally. And we all need to do that for ourselves and for our countries and for our world and for each of you, for everybody who's part of this meeting and listening and watching and participating. When you're 90, maybe you're 90 now, but when you're 90, you're going to be rolled out into an auditorium of high school kids. And they're going to say, oh my God, you were there in the great coronavirus crisis of 2020? What was it like? And you're going to tell a story. And now is the time when we need to make sure that the story we tell is, it was a rough time, but I rallied and I found the best of who I am and what I stood for. And that's the story that we have to be spending a lot of our time on. We have to be answering the question of who we are, because only then we'll be able to set a navigational map toward where we're going. But once we know that, then we need to pivot toward building that world. And that's the third part of my talk. So I'm going to turn the knob of our magical device back from this telescope to the microscope, because we're going to start from small and we're going to go to big. Under the microscope, we see this virus. We have to fight this virus. Our scientists need to fight this virus. But the virus, as I said in the beginning, the virus needs a host. And we have to fortify the hosts. And those hosts right now are our most vulnerable populations, whether it's our elders or people in various populations that are immunocompromised or have underlying health conditions. Those are the hosts. Our health resides in those people. We're all in this together. So to fight the virus, we have to fortify the hosts. We turn the knob a little bit in this same direction. Personal responsibility. What does this pivot mean to each of us? For a lot of us, it means we need to reconstruct the essence of the villages that our ancestors left. We need to have a virtual emotional closening to counteract our physical social distancing. And that means looking out for each other, making even call lists or Zoom lists of the most vulnerable people, the elderly, people who are alone, and reaching out to them. We all need to have this little piece of FDR and Churchill and Gandhi in us. But the key to all of this is recognizing our deep and essential interdependence. Because if we don't recognize how connected we are, then looking out for ourselves only will actually undermine ourselves and our world. And on a national level, we need to recognize this same thing, that our security is global, that no country, maybe New Zealand is as close as you can get, but almost no country can get through this on its own. If you build a wall, like here in the United States, we built a wall insanely on the Mexico border, and now it turns out the United States is the hotspot, and it's dangerous for Mexicans to come here. We all need to recognize that we are interdependent. And I talked about the brunt of this pandemic moving into the Southern Hemisphere. And so let's just say hypothetically that we get a reprieve here in the United States and in the wealthier parts of the world over our summer. But if this virus goes to Central African Republic or Bangladesh or wherever, and it mutates and grows and then comes back here in the fall, that's a danger to us. My health resides in every person living in the Central African Republic and vice versa. That's what interdependence is about. And we recognize this deep interdependence, then helping each other isn't an act of charity. It's actually the ultimate act of self-preservation. It's even an act of benign selfishness. And so here in the United States, we just had a $2 trillion stimulus bill. And that's certainly important that we help our economy here. But what percentage of that should we be spending to help strengthen public health infrastructures in the poorest countries of Africa? We would get a great return on investment by doing that, but that's not the way our political leaders are thinking. And then when we widen our aperture a little more, we need to see how we're organized globally. And there's a structural problem here, which is the fundamental mismatch between the global shared nature of the biggest problems, the biggest existential problems that we face, and the national way we're organized to address them. And that's the core problem. We've all empowered our states to look out for our narrow interests. At the end of the Second World War, we created these international organizations, but our states never fully empowered them, because that's what states do. They withhold the prerogative of their power and sovereignty. And that's why every major common existential threat is not being addressed. Not just deadly pandemics, climate change, ecosystem destruction, weapons of mass destruction, the list goes on. And that's why I'm spending a lot of my time, my life's energy right now, advocating for a structural shift in the way that we are organized globally. Our stool is wobbly of global power because we only have two legs of the stool. There are states and there are international organizations, which are critical, but they are created, funded, and controlled by states. And we need a third leg of the stool, and that is the democratic expression of the common will of our shared humanity. Everybody on Earth wants to have a World Health Organization with the ability to stop deadly pandemics in its tracks, in their tracks. Everybody on Earth wants to make sure that we don't have an ecosystem collapse in our oceans, and that the diversity of the species that make up our natural world, of which we are a part, are maintained. And that's why I'm working with people all from over 30 countries on a new interdependence initiative that recognizes that. We'll be releasing next week our Declaration of Interdependence, and then we're going to be starting some very specific global campaigns to rally people around this idea of interdependence, not as some foofy, crazy concept, but as the essence of our safety, security, and stability as a species. And this crisis, it's really terrible, but it's forcing us to take a hard look at ourselves. And some things are really working well. There are lots of ways that we're better off. Our literacy rates are higher than they've ever been. There are a lot of great stories, but there are big parts of our world that were already broken. And what this virus and this pandemic and this crisis have done is to show that that world with these high levels of inequality, of unequal access to just basic human goods and needs like water, sanitation, education, if our health, our safety, our security resides in each other, there's no us and them. There's us and us. And we have to recognize that. So the final shift of this magical optical machine that we have is we're going to turn it into a telescope, but we're going to take it up into space and we're going to turn it around and we're going to look at our planet from this telescope positioned in space. And what do we see? We see one shared home, one shared ecosystem that we are part of. We see one common humanity within that ecosystem. And this virus, as terrible as it is, has shown us that we are all one interconnected humanity. And the question for all of us is whether we can transform this painful lesson into a better world for all of us. That's the essence of this moment. That's the responsibility that we all share. And so my topic, the official topic of this title, was hacking the coronavirus. But the real question for all of us is whether we can hack ourselves. Thank you.
The Q&A with Professor Toby Walsh.
Thank you, Jamie. That was wonderful. What is your story about when you realized what a big deal this was going to be?
It was actually 23 years ago when I was on the U.S. National Security Council, and my then boss and now very close friend, Richard Clark, was the person who was talking about the threat of terrorism and the threat of actually Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. And nobody would listen. And when 9/11 happened, Dick's very prescient memo was on President Bush's desk. And Dick always used to say that the key to effectiveness and impact was seeing things before other people saw them, seeing around the corner. And so 23 years ago, I really was asking myself that question very deeply. And I kept coming back to this feeling that the genetics and biotech revolutions were going to fundamentally transform our world. So I started educating myself. I'm entirely self-taught in the sciences. I guess I did take a biology class in 10th grade of high school. And when I was ready, I started writing scholarly papers about this. And I was just frustrated because I was writing, I was speaking. And then a member of the United States Congress read one of my articles, asked me to testify. And that started this process, first of doing more, working with the United States government. And then to get my message out, I felt like I needed to reach a broader audience. So I started writing science fiction novels, like you mentioned in your introduction, Toby. And I, when I was talking to people about the genetics revolution, I could tell that when they heard it from me, a storyteller, all of a sudden they got it, that there was all of this technology, all of the words, DNA, genetics, and people knew it was somehow important. They didn't know the story. And that was when I realized that I needed to write the story of our past, present, and future of a species, of our, as a species. And that's what Hacking Darwin is. And for me as a futurist, I mean, my parents who are watching this show in Kansas City, they're both doctors. And the way you know that they're doctors is you go to their office and you look on the wall and there's a little piece of paper that says you're a doctor. When you're a futurist, which everybody knows is, it's just kind of a made up title, you better prove yourself every day because otherwise you're just a presentist or a pastist. And so very long time ago, almost 20 years ago, I started mapping out where I thought the genetics and biotech revolutions would head. As a matter of fact, I testified before United States Congress. And it's pretty exactly where we are now. And we're seeing this fundamental transformation across the board, but there are three areas where it's really hitting us. One is the fundamental transformation of our healthcare systems from generalized medicine based on population averages to precision medicine and healthcare, which is what we're moving toward now, to predictive medicine, healthcare, health, and life, where from the moment of birth or before, you'll know a lot and your parents will know a lot about your risks and maybe special opportunities. Then the second application will be in do-it-yourself genomics. People already are getting information about ancestry and other things. We're going to get a lot more information that people will feel is relevant to parenting, to even to identity. And then the third area is in its application to assisted reproduction. And that's why I talk about the end of procreative sex over time, because we're going to apply more and more science, not just to baby making, but also to transforming the nature of the babies that we make. As I mentioned before, we already are doing embryo selection. We already have three CRISPR babies that we know of. And I write about this in Hacking Darwin. We'll have hundreds within a decade, and we'll have many thousands within 20 years. And what it is to be a human being is a moving target. We've only had this form for about 300,000 years. This was never an evolutionary terminus. We are changing, and we change with our technologies. But all of these technologies raise fundamental ethical issues. And that's why this isn't just a conversation about science. It has to be a conversation about ethics and a conversation in which everybody has a seat at the table. And that's why these kinds of dialogues are so important.
So let's start with COVID and then broaden out to these bigger topics around genetic engineering. So you've been quite vocal about the idea that most likely it came out of a virology lab in Wuhan as opposed to the wet market. My reading is that, well, it's not, the evidence is that it's probably not man-made at all. The genetic evidence points to it being naturally created, but we'll never probably work out whether that came from a lab or it came from a wet market or wherever. Do you think we'll ever work out? Is it important that we really work out where it came from? I mean, the fact that we know that it is just so dangerous, and will we be able to make even more dangerous viruses in the future? And is that, you mentioned that you started to worry about this when you were working with the National Security Council and terrorists and so on. Should we be worried that terrorists and rogue states are going to come up with even worse viruses?
It's a really great question, Toby. So let me take it point by point. First, and let me say at the outset, I totally and completely disassociate myself with any blame shifting, any racism and bigotry. And this is a really sensitive topic. And a lot of people with ill intentions are poking around here. And so I've been committed and dedicated most of my life to fighting for human rights. But I do think, as I said in my remarks, that it's actually critically important for us to do our best to figure out where this came from, just as if a plane crashed, we would want to know where that came from. And we need to do it in an evidence-based, thoughtful, smart way. I agree with what you said, that this does not look like it's a genetically altered or engineered virus. Certainly, we will face genetically engineered viruses in the future because it can be done relatively inexpensively. A lab in Canada a few years ago created a horsepox virus, which is a cousin of smallpox. They did it for $100,000. Now that something like that could be done for under $10,000. So we're going to see that in the future, and we have to be worried about it. But here's why it's important to know, to try to know whether this was a natural zoonotic jump or this was an accident, an accidental leak from one of the two Chinese virology labs in Wuhan. Because if there is a problem with Chinese lab security, which I believe that there is, and there's a broader problem with just the ethical and regulatory frameworks around Chinese big science, that's a really important issue. That's all of our concern. I mentioned these first three CRISPR babies. It's not coincidental that this rogue science had to alter the genome of humans when most everyone else on Earth thought this was unethical, that it happened in China. There is a Chinese science culture, and it's not as careful as it needs to be. So let's look at whether it's a natural jump. If that had been the case, where would that have happened? Because the horseshoe bats, which is the most likely reservoir host for this virus, they're in Yunnan. That's 1,100 miles away from Hubei, from Wuhan. And so if that jump had happened...
The same DNA.
Yes, yes. And so if that jump had happened somewhere else, we would have seen evidence of people who had COVID-19 likely somewhere else. If this jump happened in the seafood market, then it wouldn't make sense that there were the Lancet reports that came out in January suggesting that the cluster from the seafood market wasn't the first cluster. But what if the story is that it came out of one of the two virology labs in Wuhan? When this story came out on day one, I said, well, this sounds really suspicious because I track China a lot. And I know when they have these breakouts, they happen in the south, in Guangdong or Yunnan, in the more tropical areas. They don't happen in Wuhan or in Hubei, at least historically. They don't have that many bats there. And the bats there are hibernating. But they do have the only level 4 virology lab in Wuhan. And we know that those virology labs were studying bat coronaviruses. And we know that when U.S. Embassy officials visited one of them in 2018, they were appalled by that they were studying these exact type of viruses and the security was so low. And we know that in the first few weeks after the outbreak, there was a massive cover-up attempt in China where evidence was destroyed. People were forced to retract things. And even now, we don't have that level of openness. So I don't know whether we'll ever know, but it's really important that we know. But then it's also important that we recognize that this is an ongoing threat. And even if and when we get over this crisis, which we will, there are going to be more of them. And that's why we can't accept the world as it is. We can't accept that we have a World Health Organization that doesn't have a global surveillance capability, that doesn't have inspection teams that can immediately go anywhere in the world, that doesn't have the resources and mandate to organize a coordinated global response. We can't accept that we're not working with African countries and South Asian countries and others to build up their public health infrastructures. That world is broken
and worse is coming. The rate of these pathogens showing up is increasing because of climate change, because of ecosystem destruction, because of the way that we are living. And if we can't build up our defenses and our capacities and help each other, we're in even bigger trouble.
So I buy your argument that if we can find out the source, then we can see whether this is a major risk and we need to be pushing the Chinese on the standards within their labs. But the idea of wet markets, do we not already have enough evidence that from SARS in the past and MERS, that this is a major risk to the world, and that we really should be pressing China to be closing down these wet markets, or at least to be regulating them in a much more thorough way?
You know, Toby, that's a trick question, because you know my answer. Like, obviously, they should shut down these wet markets. Obviously, eating pangolins and civets, I want to be culturally sensitive. It's disgusting. It's unhealthy for humans. It should not be happening. Nobody should be having shark fin soup. And you know, we should look at the entire way that we're using natural resources. But as I said, I don't for a minute believe that this wet market is actually the source of this virus. But it doesn't matter. Why were these wet markets still happening when we know the history of SARS? And it really doesn't make sense. And the Chinese government, the Chinese government is perfectly willing to put 1 million Uyghurs into concentration camps and to brutally suppress the Tibetans, but stopping people from selling and eating pangolins and civets, that's a bridge too far. I don't buy it. I don't want to point fingers at China. I mean, I pointed a very strong finger at the United States, my home country. Nobody is perfect. But if we don't get our act together and recognize that we're all connected and we all have to work together, and if China doesn't totally open up its records, its labs, and let international inspectors come work collaboratively, interview people who are in those labs, this cover-up is still happening. And this kind of behavior, it's not just a China sovereign issue. This is a fundamental threat to the world, just like there are things that the United States is doing. Like right now, we have a president who's telling people from the White House podium that they should be injecting Lysol. That's a threat to the world. When he talked about chloroquine, people in Africa started taking chloroquine and people died. We have mutual responsibilities. And that means that we have to hold ourselves accountable, and it's okay to hold each other accountable.
So I'm sure all of us are now very painfully aware of what a global threat is. But I'm wondering, you raised the idea that we could be genetically engineering these quite easily now, quite cheaply now. How much worse could you actually make it if you genetically engineered it? I mean, could we get a larger R0? Could we get a greater fatality rate? I mean, obviously, you don't want to be too fatal, otherwise you kill the carriers too quickly. I get the feeling that respiratory transmission is about as bad as you can get. But I'm wondering, how much worse could we get than this?
And the answer is a lot worse. As a matter of fact, you talked about your view, which is also my view, that this is likely not a synthetically engineered virus. But in the seminal Nature Medicine article, where they really looked at that question, the way one of their primary pieces of evidence was, if your goal was to genetically engineer a virus to cause harm to humans, this was a botch job. It was, you could do so much better, and it doesn't take, you don't need to be the world's greatest virologist to figure out how to do that. So yes, there's much worse that's coming. As a matter of fact, I have a piece with Andrew Hessel and Hansa Bargava coming out in CNN.com on Monday about this. And worse is coming. Worse is coming. We know it. If we can't organize ourselves to develop the kind of global public health function that we need, then shame on us. And we could be having this exact same conversation in a different scenario, imagine that rather than a deadly pathogen, there was a nuclear device that had gone off, or nuclear devices had gone off in Washington, in London, in Moscow and Beijing, all on the same day. We'd be having this exact same conversation. We'd say, oh, there are decades of reports. We knew there was this global common threat, but we couldn't do anything. If we had an ocean ecosystem collapse, we'd be having this exact same conversation. And the question is, how can we organize ourselves to solve these common threats? And one, intellectually, we have to recognize our interdependence, but then we have to build infrastructures around that idea. I think every country should have a ministry of existential threats where they're looking at these issues. The United Nations should have an existential threat agency that's empowered to look at what are the biggest threats, what do we need to do to be better prepared, and empowered to continuously move an agenda forward. We have to get organized because this stuff is only going to get worse.
So picking that idea up, that we really need to be thinking about the institutions and the changes, and that really interesting historical analogy you made, that we've already been through such a transformation in the past when we went through the end of World War I, World War II, and we changed society. We introduced institutions like the United Nations, and we went through a great period of growth, of the world, inequality in the world improving, life expectancy getting better. We made the world a much better place after that. But I'm worried because it took a failure. We failed at the end of World War I to get it right. We went through the Great Depression. And it seems to me if we're not very careful now, we'll go into another depression and we will fail just like we did the first time. And we'll have to have a second shock like World War II was before we can actually really get our act together.
Yeah. This could, yeah. I for sure see hope. So first, this could be that crisis. And that was why I used the Gramsci quote. This could be, and I believe this is, the end of this post-war order. And there's a race, as I mentioned before, between the forces of construction and the forces of destruction, because the bad guys, the supranationalists, they're having meetings kind of like this, using these same tools, recognizing the opportunity of this moment. And for those of us who recognize our interdependence, we can't just think that, you know, tuning into a lecture, as great as I hope it is enough. We have to be building. And that's why what I always say is this is an all hands on deck moment for our species. And anybody who's sitting home binge watching Netflix isn't understanding both the magnitude of this moment and your individual role in fighting for the world that you want to live in, and I think we all want to live in, and that's the charge of now.
So you've worked inside, organizations like the World Health Organization, which is presumably one of these institutions that we need to grow and strengthen to deal with these sorts of risks. Who has an impossible job? I know it's received. Mm-hmm. You did criticize it a little bit, but it has an impossible job where it only works at the invitation of the countries involved. And so it had to walk an incredible line with the Chinese, not to be too critical so that it would still maintain access. It still has, you look at the way it deals with, Taiwan and so on. It has to walk an incredible diplomatic line. And I wonder if it, how could we strengthen, how could we give it the tools so that it could actually do the right job. And more fundamentally, whether the sort of rules-based order that we grew out of World War II, that the institutions like the United Nations and the WHO represent, whether that is not actually fundamentally just breaking down, and we see some new post-truth world in which it's much more inward and less and nationalistic than the ideals that the global ideals that we need to deal with these global threats.
Yeah. So let me take those two questions in order. First, on the WHO, I mentioned the interdependence movement that I founded, and now we have hundreds of people working together. The first thing that we're going to do after our our declaration, is going to be have commission a very fast but study where we're going to ask four questions. One is, if we were starting from scratch, what's the world health function that we need? Two, what's the difference between that function and what we have? And that's the need. Three, what are the emergency things that the World Health Organization needs to have now in terms of resources, personnel, mandate, and other things so that we can act right away, especially to help the poorest and most vulnerable countries in the world? And fourth is, what's a medium-term strategy for shifting the WHO and the global health function we have toward the one that we need? But all of that, the WHO exists, as you correctly mentioned, Toby, within the context of our international order, of this rules-based system. And that system didn't exist on its own. That's why I talked about my remarks in Wuhan in 2018. It didn't exist on its own. There was a set of principles that was in many ways backed by the military might of the United States. There were a lot of other players, a lot of other factors, but that was one of the most essential pillars. And I think many of us, certainly here in the United States, very tragically, have come to see this built environment, which our ancestors, parents, grandparents, they fought and died for these principles. I myself am my father, who's again listening in Kansas City. He came to this country as a refugee from Nazism. I deeply believe in these principles. But too many of us have come to see the peace, security, and stability that we have as just some kind of state of nature, not a constructed environment that many, many people came together to build and over generations strengthen and maintain. And you're right. If we don't fight for it, we're going to lose it. And then we're going to go back to that world of balance of power politics. And as I said before, we know how this movie ends. It ends in war. It ends in crisis. And I would not even be surprised if we had some kind of military skirmishes by the end of this year, because the United States tragically has given up its global leadership, its moral standing, its economic role, its ability to show other countries that we know how to handle things. And China, for all of its flaws, has actually done a pretty good job of containing this virus after the terrible, monumental, and incredibly deadly and dangerous screw up in the beginning. And so if the United States, if the tool, the primary tool in America's toolkit is our military, and we're not using all of these incredibly and far more powerful tools of soft power, example, democracy, values, allies, if the military becomes our only or primary tool in our toolkit, there's going to be an instinct to use it, especially because China is becoming incredibly aggressive in the Taiwan Strait, in the South China Sea, and elsewhere. And I think just like in 2008, when China felt that the United States was on its knees because of the financial crisis, and they shifted from this peaceful rise model to let's grab everything we can as quickly as possible, I think China is likely, and Russia are likely, to shift to that mode if the United States can't get its act together. And so this is a really dangerous, dangerous time. And if that's not where we want to go, we all need to be organizing. And we need to be organizing for a politics on the local, national, and global level that better reflects our common aspiration as humans sharing the same planet and sharing this same home. And that's the challenge.
The frightening observation is that if you look back at the history of the last 1,000 or so years, we've had a major pandemic every 100 or so years. We've had a major depression every 100 or so years. We've had major wars every 100 or so years. I'm just a bit worried that, which is exactly the time it takes for a generation to forget and the next generation to come along, yeah, and rediscover those lessons from last time. I'm just worried that we're going to have to rediscover the same lessons that we learned 100 or so years ago with the two world wars, the Great Depression, and the change that happened again.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I talked about I talked about people in the United States coming to see politics not as a sacred space where people who with very different backgrounds come to negotiate common approaches, but as a form of entertainment, kind of like a boxing match. And you just vote for somebody who's going to stick it to the man and drain the swamp. When the swamp is us in a democracy, the government is us. That's why I called it an autoimmune disease. And globally, you know, the United States, you know, has definitely been imperfect. But it's not that really a lot of countries have stepped up. There have been a lot of free riders, and the United States has carried this burden and benefit on its shoulders for a long time. And as someone who, again, who really believes in this country and, you know, our United States and Australia, I mean, we are historically joined. Those Marines in Guadalcanal, they were fighting for us, but all of Australia is different because of what happened there, because of the Americans and Australians and others fighting together. And we can't lose this battle. And America is down, but we're not out. We still stand for something. We still have a lot of idealism here. We have an election coming up. I sound like a partisan here, but I have lots of friends who are Republicans who believe in this country and what we stand for and the international system and our allies and friends and doing the right thing, and that we shouldn't inject Lysol into our into ourselves. There is that America is not dead, but we've all got to come together on every level.
I want to just broaden the conversation to genetic engineering and the promise and hope and the perils that poses for the final 10 minutes of our conversation. Supposing we fix the world order, we fix the institutions so that we can deal with these challenges like pandemics and all the other existential risks that face the world. One of the risks there is that, and we've already seen this beginning November last year, is that, you know, maybe China's just going to completely win the genetic engineering race. We're already seeing CRISPR-modified babies in China, and they have a number of reasons in terms of data, in terms of attitudes to privacy, and in terms of ethics that means that they may go down that road quicker, faster, more dangerously even than we would here in the West. So will China just completely win this race and use that for economic and other advantage?
It could. And there's a tendency for liberal people to say, well, science is always a win-win, that science that happens anywhere is science that happens everywhere. And sometimes that is true. And there are some times when science is a zero sum. It's not coincidental that America has all of these big internet behemoth companies and Amazon and Google. And it's because the internet was invented here and our companies had a head start. And so there is a zero-sum element to technology. I mean, that's America's post-war wealth comes from these heroes like Vannevar Bush, who helped build this science and technology juggernaut that was a foundation of American wealth and power. And we don't know the answer to that question, but certainly China's government sees scientific leadership as a key to its goal to be the leading global power by 2049. So that's the race that they're on. That's what the Thousand Talents are about. That's frankly why we see so much risk-taking in the Chinese scientific community, because the message they are getting from Beijing is that science is the way to put China where the Chinese government believes that it needs to be. You mentioned data. So right now we have three models of data privacy. There's China, minimal data privacy, Europe, lots of data privacy, the United States, somewhere in the middle. There will be an answer about what's the best way to do data to advance science. It could be that if you have weakest privacy protections, the data is the most accessible, and then you get a head start. It could be if you have the strongest privacy protections, people trust the data and you get higher quality data, which is why, for example, the UK Biobank is the best genetic database in the world, even though there are other countries that have bigger ones. Or it could be that this US position for now, somewhere in the middle, is optimal. The way that we're going to find out is 20 years from now, we're going to see where these world leading companies are, that what scientists have the greatest access and are making the biggest advances. And the same is true for scientific cultures and all of those things. So China absolutely sees science as part and parcel of its national strategic plan around the Chinese dream and Chinese renaissance as they see it. That doesn't mean we all have to see science in that way. I think it's great that we see science as a new frontier, as a way to enhance our capabilities and improve our health and make our lives better. But if there's at a moment like this, we really need to ask the tough questions about what's the kind of science that we want. And because, as you know, I believe what we're experiencing now is a manifestation of China's science race, where it doesn't have the infrastructure. And it's actually my view, and I can't prove it, that China was actually in a very well-intentioned way trying to develop vaccines and preventions for these exact viruses if they had this mistake in Wuhan and the leak. And I put all the evidence on my jamiemetzl.com website, and you know, people can go there and decide for themselves. But science is the domain. We are at a moment where we're seeing exponential scientific advance. We're seeing a super convergence of all of these technologies. And so our lives are just fundamentally changing, and the rate of this change is only going to pick up.
So let me get to one of those tough questions. You've said the very essence of what it means to be human is ultimately at play here. So what is the essence of what it means to be human, and what might we actually lose if we get it wrong?
So there's no full answer to that, because it's always changing. If you had asked our ancestors in the savannah what was the essence of being a human, they probably wouldn't have understood what you were saying. But I think they would have said it's survival. That's the essence. We are blessed to live in a time where, for most of us, even at a time like this, survival isn't at risk. And so what is the essence of being human? What's the essence of being human at a time like now, when we're physically separated from each other, but we can share ideas like this, we can share emotions? Maybe it's to love each other. Maybe it's to procreate. I don't think there's one answer to that. I think that it's evolving. But I think that we all need to be part of that conversation. And that's why, again, coming back to this interdependence issue, part of the essence of being human, I think, is looking out for other humans. And we can't go on feeling like it's okay for me to be here in New York, kind of thinking philosophically and musing about the meaning of life, when there are people in the Central African Republic or elsewhere who are starving in the middle of war zones. And if there is an essence, it's both individual and communal. And as I said before, this pandemic is teaching us about our interconnectivity. And the question is, can we learn those lessons? And then can we act upon them?
Q&A with the audience.
The first question is from Carrie Webster. And this is a very important question. What happens if there is no vaccine? And of course, there are other viruses for which there are no vaccines. So maybe there won't be one this time.
It's a great question. And if there is not a vaccine, it's not that this virus is going to kill us all. It's just that it will kill some of us. And that is a terrible, terrible tragedy. But eventually, we'll develop herd immunity. And so if there's not a vaccine, we can use these tactics that we're using. But eventually, most of us will get it. And the most vulnerable people who would have this the worst response to their experience of it, if too many of us have the experience at once, there won't be enough healthcare. But even if we can flatten the curve, even people who have this and have full access to healthcare, some percentage of those people will die. And we don't know. Earlier on, the World Health Organization said that percentage was 3.4. It's looking now, it's something closer to one. But that's a lot of people in a world of 7.7 billion, billion humans. And I'm quite confident that we will get a vaccine. There already are some veterinary vaccines for coronaviruses. 100 years ago, at the time of the Spanish flu, the world population was 2 billion people, and there was a 20% literacy rate. That meant that for kind of any big problem, you had about 400 million people who could be part of the conversation. Now we have 7.7 billion humans and an 85% literacy rate. So that means we have about 6.5 billion minds all connected to each other, or many of them connected to each other through these very powerful networks. And I think we can solve any problem, including a vaccine. So I'm extremely confident that we'll get one, but we may not. And that's what I think would happen if we don't.
So a related question, this is from Jackie Abernathy, Summer Winter. Will widespread antibody testing be a game changer?
We don't know yet. It could be, but the person alive who's had antibodies the longest has only had this for 5.5 months. So we don't yet know exactly what kind of protections people would get, but we're going to learn more. And eventually, I hope it'll be possible for people who have antibodies, if we can show that there are protections and there are reasons to believe that it's likely that there will be some protection. We don't know for how long. We'll be able to move around a little bit more. I know Italy was talking about having people have passes, or maybe likely it'll be something on people's cell phones. So it's not going to be a game changer overnight, but we are going to incrementally have more information. We're going to have better and more ubiquitous testing. We're going to have these serology or antibody tests, and we're going to know what they mean. So not a game changer overnight, but eventually, collectively, it'll move us in a positive direction.
And then one for me, because it's sort of related, which is, is this going to be potentially also a game-changing cure, this idea that we can use plasma with the antibody resistance in it as a way of helping people through?
So convalescent plasma is one possibility, and there are many reasons, and monoclonal antibodies, which is essentially the same kind of thing. It's hard to do because you need a lot of people who are donors, so you would first have to have the antibody test. You'd have to learn about what kind of resistance people who have had COVID-19 have. Then it's still about 3 to 1 in terms of donors, blood donors to transfuse, 3 donors to transfuse 1 person. So I think that we have a lot of different approaches, and convalescent plasma is one. There are different kinds of vaccine approaches. And we're marching down all those paths simultaneously. And better treatments are also going to help, because if we have really good treatments, that will increase people's ability to take risks. Because if you get it and you know that it's not going to be terrible, then we'll be able to open up more.
Okay, I'm going to move on to some US-centric questions. Victor McGill, we're seeing signs of civil disobedience. How does Jamie think this will unfold, particularly in the economic impacts and Trump's inability to avoid it really impact, particularly in the Midwest?
Yeah, I'm really worried about this. My brother, Jonathan Metzl, is a leading expert on just this transformation. He has a great book called Dying of Whiteness that came out last year. That's talking about just this gulf. It's almost, we have people in the United States who are just living in alternate realities and heavily armed. There's constant messaging that the system is rigged. And I talked earlier about how I'm really worried about what's going to happen in our elections in November. So it's not crazy to imagine some kind of scenario where there's some difference in the outcome or a contested election, because a lot of people are going to be voting electronically, voting by mail. It's something we've never done before. Our voting infrastructure is already hackable, as we saw in 2016 with the Russian hacks that, among other things, it probably shifted the outcome of our elections. And so let's just say that Vice President Biden wins and President Trump doesn't recognize the outcome. And is it crazy to say that he would call on his supporters to take one action or another or to not accept it? I think that we can't take civic culture for granted. And you look at countries like Iceland, like Germany, that have strong civic cultures and senses of mutual responsibility. I'm very involved with South Korea. When they had the financial crisis in Korea, people lined up in front of the banks, not to take their money out, but to give their gold to the banks to help the country. That would never happen here in the United States. So I think we're going to have to, again, it keeps coming back to this issue of interdependence. We're going to have to reconstruct our civic culture. And that also means that we have to build a table big enough for everybody. I probably am some kind of smug liberal. And I'm sure if I was at a different perspective and I was watching me now, I would be irate at me. And that means if we're talking about interdependence, if we're talking about connectivity, we need to build bridges because we're one humanity. And even people who we disagree with pretty fundamentally are also part of our one humanity. And we have to find ways to come together.
So a couple of questions now I'm going to conflate, because they're all about how democracy is failing us. One from Lin Fu. The role of democracy as a governance safeguard, given the latter seems to have broken down. And another one from Fran Rigby. Bad political leaders, and I think we know who she's talking about, play on loss of hope and fear in the general population to push an argument. Yeah. That's largely around self-interest. How do thought leaders break through this inertia to open the general public up to a possibility of a different, more connected future?
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. And certainly there are some democracies that have done a fantastic job of responding. I mentioned South Korea, Germany, Iceland, Taiwan is a wonderful democracy. And in their democracy, they maybe did the best response job of everybody. The United States, we have failed. And our democracy used to be a model that we pushed out and that others looked to. And that's not the case right now. That doesn't mean that our democracy is dead. It can be rediscovered. But when you look at why we're suffering, why so many people are dying in the first place, it's the fundamental deadly failure of the authoritarian Chinese system that didn't allow its own network to be triggered. That the officials, first in Wuhan and now in Beijing, were involved in a massive cover-up, and they're still doing it. And so we are suffering from the failure of democracy here in the United States, and democracies have worked well elsewhere. And we are suffering as a world and in China from just the fundamental failure of the Chinese system. But the test of all of our systems is, are they driving results? Democracy or anything else, it's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. And that end is good governance and accountability and freedom. And certainly the United States is failing on that regard. And certainly China, which has done in the second stage a better job than the United States of addressing this pandemic threat. But no country that has a million Uyghurs in concentration camps and is squashing the rights of Tibetans can hold that out as a model. Neither of us are perfect, but we really need to say is, what are the basic inherent rights of a human being? And how can we find different government systems that can support that right, those rights? I mean, there's lots of different ways to do things, but I think that's what we need to rally around.
So, Jamie, unfortunately, our time is starting to run out. So one last question from the audience. And I've chosen it because I think it is one of the most important questions. And it's a topic that hasn't really come up much so far in our conversation, but I think is incredibly important to the solution of this. It's a question from Linda Peach. Do you think a key outcome of this pandemic will be a shift towards a more equal distribution of wealth across the globe? Or are we more likely to see an acceleration of the wealth gap we currently have that is driving many of these challenges?
So I think that's a fantastic question and a great question to end on. And I think you'll know what I'm about to say. That's up to us. Our world is fundamentally unstable because of this inequality. As this pandemic shifts toward poorer countries, we are going to be harmed because of this inequality. Here in the United States, where we have such disparate levels of access to healthcare, this pandemic is growing. And so the right answer is we need a fairer distribution of wealth within and between our countries and our world. We may get to that answer, or we may get a totally different answer. And I wish I could say, but we have our government leaders and they're on it. And maybe if you're in a country like New Zealand or one of these smaller, more enlightened places, you can say, all right. I mean, if I was in New Zealand, I would say, you know, the prime minister, she's doing a great job. I'm just going to support her and I'm going to relax and I'm going to go back to doing what we do in New Zealand. And we're not bumpkins. We know it's not just sheep farming. But that's the question. This is all of our responsibility. Our leaders aren't doing this for us, but we have these incredible tools, like the tool that allows us to have this virtual conversation from the other side of the world. And we need to organize ourselves and we need to rally behind our principles, because if we want to live in the world that Linda has articulated, we've got to come together to build it.
Well, Jamie, thank you very much. I think I'm going to agree with you. We should elect the Prime Minister of New Zealand as the Prime Minister of the world. And then we can all look forward to a wonderful, happier future. Thank you so much. It's been a really interesting conversation. I've learned a lot. And there's so much more to think about. I encourage everyone to go and buy Jamie's book and read it. It's a wonderful read. And just to say, to finish up, Jamie, is there anything more you'd like to share with us?
So first, I want to say thank you all to all of you. It's a scary, scary moment for everybody. But it's at just a time like this where we all need to come together. We need to learn together. We need to support each other. And we need to inspire the best in each other. We, our species and our countries, we have faced much worse challenges than this, and we've gotten through them. But I want everybody to think about the challenge that I put to you earlier in my remarks. Someday, people are going to ask you, what did you do in 2020 with all of the chaos? And I want you to be able to say, that's when I reached deep and I found my very, very best. Let this be that moment. So thank you so much to all of you.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the Think Inc. podcast. For more, head to thinkinc.org for the full showcase of what we have on offer. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe. Your support allows us to keep doing what we do, and we appreciate each and every one of you. See you next time.